Sana. This is part of our 8-country election series in partnership with Hendrik Boll Foundation. The election series that we have will be covering broad themes: women's political participation, media and security. These are themes that cut across all elections in the Eastern Horn of Africa. The countries that we are covering in this series are Tanzania, Uganda, South Sudan, Sudan, Somalia, Somaliland, Ethiopia, and Djibouti. So earlier this year, the Ethiopian government announced the postponement of all parliamentary and regional elections to curb the spread of COVID-19. This was postponed. The move was later endorsed through a constitutional interpretation adopted by the House of Federation. However, opponents of the Prime Minister, particularly the Tigray People's Liberation Front, saw the delay as a strategy for the Prime Minister to extend his term beyond its original mandate. As a result, the Tigray region held its own parliamentary elections on 9 September 2020, a move that exacerbated an already tense political atmosphere in the country. In October, as we are aware, the political tensions escalated and a military conflict between Tigray and Ethiopian National Defense Forces started in November. Massive mobilization and heavy fighting across the region ensued, with thousands of Tigrays being displaced, including over 30,000 crossing the border into neighboring Sudan and I think some in South Sudan. With telecommunications lines cut and the internet switched off, there's very limited space for civil society and humanitarian actors to operate in this region, and coverage of the conflict by media is patchy and obstructed. We hope that this forum and panel discussion will add to the insights and perspectives on the role that regional bodies and civil society can play in managing and mitigating the conflict, which threatens the lives of thousands of people in and around the Tigray region, plus the stability of Ethiopia and the Horn of Africa more broadly. Our moderator today is Mosab Baba. Mosab is the co-director and media development director of GISA Group, which is a media development and civic engagement organization based in Sudan. Our panelists today are Rashid Abdi, a research and political analyst with Sahan, Peter Kamalingin, of the Pan-African Program Director, representative to AU from Oxfam International, Kibreb Abera Lomencho, a lawyer and activist based in Ethiopia, and Rita Musachi, who is the Secretary of the Horn of Africa Civil Society. My name is Pauline Otieno-Skepa, and I'm the forum manager here at the Rift Valley Institute. The Rift Valley Forum is a neutral platform that is dedicated to critical exploration and discussion and debate on important political, economic, and social issues within the Horn and Eastern Africa. Being very aware of the situation in Ethiopia and the tensions therein, we ask that we all present ourselves in a democratic and respective manner. There is no either or in the discussion in this space. We're just here to interrogate and try and find analysis and some kind of way forward. So interrogating the obvious gray space that is wide between these two polarizing sides. So thank you, panelists. I think we will start really by setting the context, Brigade. And I'd like to start with you, Rashid.
Thank you very much, Pauline. I think the situation in Ethiopia is very fluid, continues to change day by day. We have seen 4 weeks of very intense fighting between the TPLF and the Ethiopian federal government, supported by a coalition of ethnic forces drawn from the federal states. Now, the government claims to be in total control of Tigray and a few days ago captured the city Mekele. However, the TPLF continues to dispute that is the case. The government has imposed a complete total media and communication blackout all across Tigray. So it is actually very difficult to get verifiable information, but also to deploy independent observers or media to basically find out what is happening. So I must stress that the picture remains in Ethiopia extremely murky and very difficult to verify. However, what we know is that there are skirmishes continuing in many parts of Tigray, and we are beginning to see all the hallmarks of an insurgency which is taking root. I think the TPLF probably left Mekele before the ENDF took over with the bulk of their weaponry, but also with their leadership intact. So as we predicted, I think a number of times, this war is not going to be over anytime soon. It's going to be with us for a long time. Of course, no one doubts the firepower of the ENDF, but the terrain and the geography and the history of Tigray clearly suggests that this is going to be a long drawn out insurgency in Tigray. But I think coming back to the point of this discussion this afternoon, which is what role civil society plays in peace and conflict, I think is quite important. In many ways, the reason why the two belligerents, I think, went to war was partly an indictment of the civil society in Ethiopia. For a variety of reasons and history, I think the civil society in Ethiopia is extremely weak, has been emasculated throughout the decades by very strong and authoritarian states, which have plagued that country for a long time. So it isn't any surprise that you don't have a very strong, very robust civil society. The other problem, I think, is that you also have a civil society that is deeply fragmented along ethnic lines. And this is, I think, not unfamiliar because it is the same case, I think, in many parts of Africa. But I think in Ethiopia, the ethnic fissures and the ethnic animosities are very deep and have actually been growing to a frightening level. Just to give you an example, the Orthodox Church historically has been very powerful and very strong, has been involved in peacemaking and conflict resolution. But the Coptic Church is now deeply split along ethnic lines. For example, the Coptic Church in Amhara State is very much stridently pro-war, whereas the Orthodox Church in Tigray, as well as Eritrea, are all in favor of peace. And that is a clear indication of actually the deep split within the civil society. But I think going forward, there is also a bigger role for civil society to play in the coming few weeks. Largely, I think, because the humanitarian situation is very bleak in Tigray. So I think there will be need for the civil society to at least mobilize and lean on the government and the TPLF to first of all allow a humanitarian corridor, a civilian safe haven, but also to push the belligerents to actually respect the humanitarian law and laws governing conflict. So I think this is going to be a very critical role. The voice of the split, deeply polarized, and you need a neutral voice. And I think for the time being, that neutral voice hasn't emerged. But I think as the horrors of war become visible in the coming days and weeks, the mounting civilian casualties, the difficulties of this conflict, I think we will begin to see the emergence of a civil society in Ethiopia. But also critically, I think this conflict is not going to be resolved by war. Ultimately, the two parties will have to come together around a table and agree some sort of a political settlement. And I think that is where also the civil society will need to play a very critical role. So that is, I think, my opening statement for the time being. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rashid. And I think that's a good segue to bring you in, Peter, of course, as the Pan-Africa Director for Oxfam. As we talk about, and Rashid has sort of laid down the groundwork very well for the civil society in Ethiopia. Looking at the regional bodies, of course, when I talk about regional bodies, the first one that comes to mind is the AU and, of course, IGAD. And sort of trying to look at what their role is at this moment in time, when Ethiopia seems to be falling apart. Ethiopia is where the AU is seated. What is their space? What can they do?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Pauline. And thanks, Rashid, as well. I think for a very good way you have laid that out. I'm happy, and thanks to the Referral Institute as well, and for everyone for making time to discuss this important issue about an important country in our region. I think maybe before I come to what you asked me on the agency of the Union, I think I just wanted to share my own anecdote. I think I was in Ethiopia at the beginning of 2018, or thereabout in the middle of 2018, after the change into the current government. And I traveled throughout all the region. And I think I want to say that I have never seen a more hopeful, more happier country than that at that moment. There was a lot of hope. It was a very hopeful country at that time. And to be fair, I think there have been some momentum out of that, that all of us thought that probably this critical country in the Horn was on its way to real transformation, which was hopefully going to also positively affect the wider Horn and the continent. Because as we all know, Ethiopia has a special place in Africa. It's the epicenter of Pan-African spirit. It reinforces that African identity and resistance to colonialism. And if you speak to many of the people who say they are Pan-Africanists, they say it's the mecca of Pan-Africanism itself, because it is part of the OAU, and it is also the location of the AU headquarters. So that is an important country. And what happens in Addis Ababa or in Abyssinia is important for the entire continent for many reasons. It is an important power. The numbers that you deal with in terms of the population, the human resource, the human capacity. And I think in many ways, and this is why a lot of the broader, greater powers from the West, the US and others, and even in the Middle East, take interest in that country, because if managed well, it is in many ways also the driver of peace and security in the Horn. So that if it is not managed well, it could also turn out to be the driver for stability in the region, in much the same way as it is also a driver for peace and security. If you look at the neighboring countries, Eritrea, Sudan, Kenya, Ethiopia, Somalia, and to some extent Egypt, even the Middle East, is an important country because of its sheer size and geographical location itself. So it must concern us, and that's why it's good that Rutschfather, you convene this meeting. If the efforts of the rest of Africa and the world to support the country to resolve its tensions is muted or somewhat weak, when a big issue has come, many of us would have noticed that, yes, there have been some efforts by the AU, but I don't think that it is commensurate to the urgency one would expect, given the ramifications that could happen if this crisis is not resolved quickly. I know that the AU, as I said, have made some efforts, and also some powers of the world have made some efforts, but it is safe to say that the effort is not exactly, as I said, significant as to measure up to what we need. I think there are different dimensions for that. One, of course, I'll come back to that, is exactly if you look at what is the nature and character of the African Union, are not yet strongly embedded in the ways of working or do not even impact significantly on the behavior of the African Union. So I think that's an important thing in itself. So the first thing around the AU is that it is first and foremost, it tends sometimes unconsciously or consciously becomes a platform where mostly governments share common things and common fears, and therefore also to that extent becomes a club of peers who protect themselves. And then for a long time, right from the OAU, there's this clause around the non-interference of the internal affairs of the state. But I think that that is something that sometimes falls through the cracks, because as we all know, nothing is really ever very internal. And I think for the case of Ethiopia, it becomes complicated, because this issue of identity politics within Ethiopia and the region, of course, is important. There are different forms of nationalisms, which shows up even in the character, as Rashid was saying, on how civil society in the entire width and breadth of Ethiopian society looks like. And so we cannot look at civil society independent of these identity dimensions in Ethiopia. That's an important element to look at. And how it also relates to governance, to politics, to economics as well, how the national economy is structured, to the dignities associated with it. And therefore, of course, it also conversely translates into fear of control by one group or the other. I think that there are also deep-rooted things around appropriation. We know that although there have been efforts, especially on investment in education and social services and all that, we know that there's still, like is the case in many countries in the continent and to some extent in the world as well, there's a lot of there are inequalities as well for historical reasons and for many other regions as well around the region. So I think in terms of what there's agency for the AU, there's agency for African leaders to play more, but as I said, I think that is going to rely a lot to the extent that the agency of people and civil society are bearing on the character of that state, so that there's enough voice to make sure that the AU itself, the leadership of the AU and the member states are responding to the demands from the African people and African civil society, and most importantly, the people of Ethiopia in their totality. So I think that this is important, that there has to be more work, hard work, I think more purposeful hard work to encourage peace and faster resolution of the conflict, and then not sticking to this idea that I said is the non-interference of internal affairs, because in the bigger picture of things, this is not only internal, it has dimensions that are regional. I think that there are forces for good within different entities in Ethiopia itself, including, as I said, civil society and the church, as Rashid was saying. Those should be, we'll find ways to do and speak a bit more, and seek more collaborative ways, if not even both behind the scenes or even direct engagement, including, I think, some of the heads of state. We need to have an understanding of the power dynamic within that space. I think that the issue of practical needs of people, food, security, livelihoods, even communication, should be protected, I think, in the region that is most impacted at the moment, because issues of humanitarian access is key to retain goodwill as well. And I think that that's the only way build peace if people are meeting basic needs, then they can be on the table. We know that there are quite a number of NGOs as well who are part of that force, but I think there's quite a bit of work that needs to be done to protect that as well. I think that's important. And then I think the issue of integration of the region needs to, as I said, it's the character of it depends on how it is formed and the ways of working. But until people are interested in the way this whether it is IGAD or AU, I think it's going to be important. Lastly, I think, is the issue of understanding. There are many externalized analyses that sometimes is off the mark on what the problem is. So I think that the academia from the region, people from the region need to have more deliberate efforts to understand what is the real cause, not necessarily what is on the headlines in the region, so that we play that again is sometimes generalized off the mark externalized analysis. I think that's what I could say for now.
Thank you, Peter. I think, you know, you've laid out a lot of very many different dynamics that need to be taken into account. You know, there's identity politics, there's regional dynamics, there's power dynamics within the country itself, there's the agency of the AU and the power of the AU, and I guess how they're also constituted as an organization with their stance of non-interference, but still trying to engage, and I would imagine have some closed door or behind the scenes diplomacy to try to get some kind of settlement in this conflict, especially as Ethiopia is an important country in the region. And I think it's necessary for them to really try and make sure that this comes to a settlement, as both you and Rashid have said. Having looked at those two sides of the coin, I think right now I'd like to bring in Kibreb. Kibreb, you're based in Ethiopia, you are in Ethiopia. And maybe just to talk to us where you think, you know, the civil society is situated within Ethiopia. We've had Rashid talk about the structure of the civil society in Ethiopia, you know, not being as strong, you know, due to a very strong government, being fragmented along ethnic lines. And, you know, there are deep splits within the civil society. So it's not a monolith. Where do you situate, especially the national civil society, not looking at the international ones, in this conflict in Ethiopia currently?
Thank you for the opportunity. Let me start with some background so that I can respond to the question that you raised. I think whenever we think about problems in the area of intervention that we can contribute as civil societies in general and civil society organizations in particular, it's very much important to understand the context and also the facts on the ground. So that would very much be important. Otherwise, it's going to be misleading, and wherever a proposed solution has worked might not work on a similar or in a relatively similar problem that we are seeing. So that's why I wanted to provide some background with regards to what the context is. So one very important point is, as most of the African countries, Ethiopia is highly affected by corruption, grand corruption, and specifically related with illicit financial flow. So in this aspect, actually, Ethiopia has lost, until 2009, it has lost almost $11 billion, which is a very huge amount of money. And on the other hand, until 2014, the Global Financial Integrity has shown in its research that on an annual basis, 1.2 up to 3.1 billion USD was flowing out of the country on a yearly basis or on annual basis. So I am raising this issue because when we discuss about this matter, I want to emphasize on the existence of a deep state and deep state actors in the country. And these actors manifested or had very much strong holding since 6 years back when Prime Minister Hailemariam was in power. So this deep state wants to have a very soft leader who will be acting as a puppet and who will be dealing with the ceremonial role while the other things are handled by these deep state actors. So the deep state actors do have some official positions like the Central Intelligence Office and other roles, and also there are informal and non-formal actors in the country. So these deep state actors were highly controlling the corruption chain in the country. So due to that reason, whenever there are civil societies, individuals who are acting against and who are doing investigative journalism works were highly and brutally attacked for many years. I'm providing this background because, you know, the conflict that's happening in the country has got direct relation with this corruption chain and the deep state actors. So after that, then when the change came, as Peter said, everyone in the country was highly hopeful about the change, the democratization, and the existence and development of more strong civil societies. So everyone was expecting that, but at the end, you know, the problems start to pop up from these deep state actors that laws should not be changed. For example, the civil society law was highly opposed by these deep state actors not to be amended. So the civil society law that got enacted in 2009 was highly suppressive, and then it formed its very weak civil societies, which were only striving to exist rather than do significant activities. And also other civil societies, cultural and also churches, were highly affected. And even these deep state actors infiltrated into the religious organs, and they were trying to attack those people who are demanding positive change in the country. We have got large number of cases which was taken to court, but at the end, these people were released after the change came. So this background is very important, because I'm going to jump in after the change happened. Then some of the deep state actors directly started to engage in creating conflicts in the country. And then this caused, almost until now, there were 113 conflicts that took lives of people, and that caused internal migration in the country. Then after that, the major actors in the deep state, which were also members of the TPLF, started disobeying the government boldly. So these people started to deny the government and the public prosecutor and the court even, which tried to arrest some people who participated in grave human rights abuses. And then the regional administration said no towards the court order, and this was a very big breach of law. And on the other hand, it instituted regional electoral commission, still against the constitution. And then finally, this regional administration and partly the deep state actors started to say that after, you know, October, there is no federal government that's going to be in control. So all people will have a role to order the army and other state apparatuses, which was really wrong. Due to this reason, tension started to be very big. And the government, believing that it could crack corruption, and it decided to print a new currency notes, which was, the way I see it, is an immediate cause for the conflict. Because there was a data that there is a very huge amount of currency which is not recognized by the National Bank, but operating within the market. So this action was one of the things that might have caused things to have more tension. And finally, as the federal government said, there was an attack on the federal army, which was accepted by leaders of the TPLF. So this caused the conflict. And after the conflict, 75% of the total arms in the country was located in the Northern Command. And this group had the ability to control that. So during this time, there was an action from the federal government, which immediately started the conflict. And then here we are in a two-sided conflict. But at last, the federal government has announced that it has totally controlled the overall region, with the exception of very small areas. So when I go back to Rashid's point, actually churches are not divided, and even religious organs like mosques are not divided. Rather, they are coming out of the deep split that happened before the last 2 years. So the previous administration and the deep state worked actually hard to split and then control and hijack these institutions. But now this is getting healed. But on the other hand, when Rashid said that churches were splitted, and the Coptic church in Amhara and the Coptic church in Tigray was the way he expressed it. But the way I see it from two dimensions. One is, actually, there is no Coptic church called Amhara, so it's the Ethiopian Coptic Orthodox Church. And that administration totally has boldly favored the government's action. And then, on the other hand, church leaders in the Tigray region has said differently. But at the end of the day, churches will be laid in different principles from governments. So there is the principle of secularity. And in this principle of secularity, of course, churches by no means can support conflicts and war, because their teaching and principle is too much different from the way governments and state operates. So it's obvious that this type of ideas can be differently reflected. But at the end, the way I see it, in civil society organizations as well, there are national civil society organizations and there are international. So as the government is very much cautious about its sovereignty and the sovereignty of the state, it may be very much cautious about the intervention of international actors at this level. So basically, the national civil society organizations who should be very much strong and who should challenge positively and who should be able to side the truths and the principles. That way, I think things will get solution. Thank you.
Thanks, Kibreb. And I think there's a couple of things you've mentioned that I think would be interesting to interrogate further as we go along. But Rita, I'd like to bring you in now to sort of talk to us a little bit about, you know, the civil society space shrinking and the quick turnaround that happened when there was that slight opening window where there was sort of space to act as civil society, and something Kibreb and Rashida also touched on, which is the role of religious organizations and the church in Ethiopia.
Okay, thank you very much, everybody, and all my previous panel speakers. I am the secretary for the Horn of Africa Forum for Civil Society, and like many of the other speakers before me have mentioned, in 2018, the civil society organizations in the Horn and our members were very excited to see what was happening in Ethiopia. We thought, okay, you know, we are seeing a prime minister who is engaging in a kind of reconciliation process, a reconstruction process. We are seeing a prime minister who has freed political prisoners, who then welcomed back a number of political opponents who had been stationed in neighboring countries. And there were political agreements, if you like, very public political agreements in that process. We're also very excited about seeing somebody like Daniel Bekele being appointed as a person in charge of the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission, somebody that we all recognize with having an extensive experience in human rights. We're very excited about the number of women appointed at different government departments and in different roles within Ethiopia. And finally, but not least, you know, there was the start of the peace process that started with Eritrea. When Prime Minister Abiy first came into power, one of the things he did, which also was very exciting in terms of freedom of expression and freedom of information, you know, was that quite a number of internet websites that had been blocked off or were not accessible were actually now accessible. So this was, you know, this was a new Ethiopia in that context, which is very exciting. The other thing is he undertook to amend or change key legislation. So one of the key legislations in this regard was actually the civil society legislation, which did get amended and actually provided more space. The other legislation he had promised to change was the press freedom legislation, which basically hasn't gone anywhere. So that's the process inside of this thing. We also agree with something Rashid said, that all of this openness was really great. However, the big gap in this process of opening up has actually encouraged debate and discussion, et cetera, et cetera. But there were no actual steps taken to actually strengthen the civil society along the way. Okay, there was a lot of liberalization, but no account was actually taken in this process of many years of kind of reducing and clamping down on civil society. So we have a political opening process with no counterpart sort of strengthening and building of the civil society. So then there is a gap, because political debates get very heated and very polarized, but then there is nobody in the system with the capacity to mediate this, much as maybe in the past, some of the elders of the communities would have done, because even that structure is not really there in place. So then we are facing quite a lot of problems, because what we're starting to see is polarization along ethnic lines. but not because of land disputes, because of past grievances that people wanted addressed, may not have been addressed, and these things that sort of come up. So then we start to get the reversal process, you know, from opening to sort of closing. So, you know, we then get in September, you know, already in September 2019, we start to get the first internet lockdowns and mobile lockdowns because of ongoing protests that happened at that time. And when we move down to this year, you know, we see after Hundessa was killed, we see Ethiopia completely locked down for a month, right? No internet, no mobile. This sort of environment, then, while it is created in order to try and control hate speech, this sort of environment actually encourages speculation, fake news, disinformation, misinformation, and actually creates more problems than was planned. We also start to see a process where political leaders are arrested in mass. After Hundessa was killed, there were almost 7,000 people arrested. We see that protests deteriorate into violence, and then we have many people killed. So this is a very, very concerning trend, which is only getting worse right now with the Tigray conflict, because whilst it is not the whole of Ethiopia that is under internet and mobile lockdown, Tigray is definitely locked down. There is no access, humanitarian access or otherwise, at the moment, subject to ICRC, who is actually present at the moment. So the lack of information feeds into the whole process of paranoia, misinformation, and disinformation. There is also, in this process of civil society, we have to include media, not only the religious. And in the media side of things, yes, you know, we start to see Ethiopian Broadcasting Corporation actually starting to talk more about human rights and even raise issues of corruption. But what we are seeing right now within this conflict is that they're basically towing the official government line. So issues about humanitarian access, protection of civilians, etc., are not necessarily being raised. We even see the Peace Commission within Ethiopia, which is a very interesting and certainly an interesting body, supporting this war. So in terms of civil society, raises big issues inside the country. When we're talking about the faith-based organizations, Kale Kibrab is right. You know, Ethiopia is a secular state. So faith-based organizations have a role, not so much in dictating or anything, but they have a role as any other civil society to bring to attention, you know, issues of society and culture and such things. So basically, there is a division because, as Kibrab clearly said, the Ethiopian Orthodox Church officially supports the government's position. This is not the position of all faith-based organizations in Ethiopia. Some of them, the Intercollegiate Association of the Faith-Based Organizations has issued a statement basically saying that, you know, to resolve this conflict, there needs to be a cessation of hostilities and there needs to be negotiation and the lives of the people have to be protected. So this is, again, maybe a polarization, but it is there. On the issue of the Orthodox Church in Eritrea, it is actually silent at the moment for very specific reasons to the context in Eritrea. The Eritrean Orthodox Church that has spoken to push for a sort of cessation of fire, humanitarian corridors, negotiation, is the Eritrean Orthodox Church in the diaspora in Northern America. The Eritrean Catholic Church has definitely spoken out and shared a peace letter, basically with the point of saying, you know, that war only destroys, it doesn't build. And the regional Catholic bishops, the Amasea, have also really requested and advised that war does not solve issues, it destroys people. So the concern here also is that whilst it is correct and appropriate for a country to target corruption issues within its territory and deal with such issues, the concern now is that this is developing more and more towards a kind of ethnic targeting of certain groups within the country, which raises this is not the first time this has happened in Ethiopia. If we go back to 1998, when the war with Eritrea first broke out, there was similar action taken. And none of that actually brought any positive result to anybody. So the key factor here is that whilst understanding that corruption issues must be dealt with and constitutional issues must be dealt with, the key factor here is that most civil society in the region also is very concerned about the impact of this war outside of Ethiopia. We are starting to see this in Sudan with 40,000 or so refugees. We're starting to see security concerns from the perspective of Kenya, Somalia, and South Sudan as Ethiopian peacekeepers are withdrawn or frozen. So basically, this is why there is a push from the regional civil societies also to look at cessation of hostilities, negotiation, humanitarian corridors, and more involvement from the African Union and those regional bodies who are actually responsible for regional security. Thank you.
Thank you, Rita. Peter, on the role of the diaspora civil society, or as Rita mentioned, our religious organizations, from your perspective and point of view, do you think they would be able to help or, you know, lend their voice and energy to this cause? Would they be listened to, or are these same divisions that have been sort of raised also follow them in the diaspora?
Thanks very much, Pauline. I think that the crisis that we see in the Horn, the epicenter being Ethiopia at the moment, is something that requires all efforts. There's nothing that must be left out, whether those are, you know, the diaspora, people within the faith organizations, and I think, as I said, most importantly, also the governments and the leadership in the region and the people of the region. I think that there's need for a lot of concerted effort. As I said again, it is shocking a bit, it is surprising that not as much is being spoken. There's quite some indifference and a sort of a wish that things would resolve themselves. There's nothing that is internal. Everything has a dimension. I think that's what needs. And I think that it is also important to locate it within what are the fears among the different people involved, both within and without the country. Fear over loss of power, fear over what is seen to be economic gains. Those are things that need to find their place in the table as well. And as you know, that these are things that are driven largely by, you know, those are the root causes. How the resources in the region, in the country are appropriated, and therefore political power is seen as a means to do that. So I think it's important to address that. But most important to realize that even as we delay from morning to tomorrow, there are people, women, children who are suffering out of the same. We must be able to make efforts to make sure that we protect as much lives as possible. And that's what is important. And then these discussions can be held. And most importantly, the regional integration around issues of trade and things that happen within this region. There has to be efforts in that direction as well. And to know that sometimes interests, both of neighbors and those who are far, can be helpful, and sometimes they are not very helpful. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's need within the IGAD, within the AU, to make sure that first within Ethiopia, what is the aggregated national interest of Ethiopia as a country with that great history that all of us are proud of? What is the need for IGAD as a region? What is our aggregated strategic interests as a region? Are these well articulated? Are we clear about this? Or we are mixing things up? So I think that, yeah, bottom line is there has to be more effort than we are seeing.
Thank you.